It's almost impossible to speak of the Me Too movement without mentioning the name of disgraced Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein. So we'll acknowledge that, then point out that the use of the phrase Me Too predates the revelations of Weinstein's alleged sexual abuse of women. And the Me Too banner has been taken up all over the world. We get an idea of how far and wide and how distinctive each country's approach is in a new book called Awakening, Me Too and the Global Fight for Women's Rights. It's the work of Megan Stone and Rachel B. Vogelstein. Rachel B. Vogelstein has worked on behalf of women and girls her entire career. She is currently director of the Women and Foreign Policy Program at the Council for Foreign Relations on Foreign Relations, CFR. Megan Stone is a senior fellow in that program and also a longtime advocate for women and girls. And Megan Stone is our guest. Megan, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be with you.
It is a pleasure. Tarana Burke, the founder of Me Too, by that name, sets the tone in the foreword. Women really do take some risks saying Me Too worldwide, don't they?
They really do, and I have to say that in writing this book, one of the greatest honors was having Tarana author the foreword of this book that really dug so deep into, you know, what has this groundbreaking movement accomplished around the world? You know, when we found that it's made a remarkable global impact, that it's spread to over 100 countries, and that it's truly changing the way that women's rights are sought and won across the globe. You know, and we had this wonderful conversation with Tarana where we were sharing with her stories that even she didn't know of what women were overcoming, you know, to be part of this movement, to say that they had been survivors or victims of sexual assault or sexual harassment. And, you know, it was a wonderful just opportunity to share with her just some of the impact of what she started as a community organizer in Selma, you know, Alabama, and in her own experience so many years earlier has truly spread globally.
Now, you were president of the Malala Fund, named after Malala Yousafzai, for several years on behalf of women and girls. Did you see much of what you're writing about in the book?
Well, I was, and that was one of the greatest privileges of my life. And I loved telling folks that my boss was a 16-year-old girl when I first started working for Malala. You know, but this was something that I saw all over the world. You know, in terms of girls and women's rights, you know, we even looked at this in the book. Of course, Malala focuses on girls' education, you know, as a big focus for her advocacy, and that's what she got the Nobel Peace Prize for. You know, but even in the book, we talk about an example of the Me Too movement in Nigeria, where young women who had gotten admitted to, you know, one of the most esteemed universities in Nigeria, it's called UNILAG, you know, really, this is like an acceptance that if your family gets for your daughter is a breakthrough moment, really. You know, it means that she's going to be able to go on to a successful life, a successful career. This is an incredible educational opportunity for any young student. And so these young women were showing up to the university and, you know, finding out that their professors were going to blackmail them into a sex for grades kind of exchange. If they would not sleep with their professors, have a sexual relationship with their professors, the professors would fail them. And, you know, this was something that was an open secret and that, you know, no one would confront until a journalist named Kiki Morty, who works for the BBC in Africa, convinced the BBC to let her go undercover with reporters and students. And for a year, they went into the classrooms and started recording, you know, what professors were doing, which made it pretty hard to deny. You know, and so that's a place where, you know, Malala's work and the work in this book definitely, you know, come together. Another place is just in Pakistan. You know, in the book, we talk about the Arat marches, which is really just means woman in Urdu. So Arat just means woman. And these were the women's marches, and these were women coming out into the streets, much like we saw in the United States, and saying, you know, that my body is my own, that I have a right not to be harassed, not to be assaulted, not to be sexually assaulted. And, you know, this caused incredible backlash, the same kind of backlash that Malala experienced for standing up for her rights. But I think that there's incredible change happening, and that was really the goal of the book, was to chronicle what are these women achieving all over the world, and what can we learn from them?
Well, and you point out there's a major moment, too, at the Malala Foundation. Talk about the 2015 Development Goals Summit and what you were able to get included.
That was such a special moment. I mean, you know, if there's any of your listeners who come kind of small town life or just never expected themselves to have those kinds of opportunities, you know, you're in great company with me, because I never in a million years thought, you know, I would be at a UN summit. You know, and I think when you come from a background, you know, where sometimes there's folks that are vulnerable or people that are pushed to the margins or experiences that just aren't seen and heard or valued, hopefully you bring that into your professional life, you know. And so for the time that I worked for Malala, taking her strong lead, clearly first and foremost, as the founder and the leader and an incredible activist and advocate, you know, but always looking at how do we bring the impacted community into the room, right? It's no good to sit at a table and just pontificate or be an expert. You know, those things help and can help develop good solutions and ideas that you can test and hopefully succeed in. But it's so important to have the community themselves, first and foremost, as experts on their own lives, clearly, you know, in the center of things. And when you go to these international summits, and I'll tell you what, I've been to many where I'm still expecting someone to tap me on the shoulder and be like, ma'am, you need to leave the G7 summit. You're not supposed to be here. But, you know, you're in these rooms and the folks who are impacted are never in the room. You know, if you went to a Syria summit about Syria relief, you would very rarely find a Syrian in the room, more than maybe even one or two Syrians, and absolutely nobody usually from those communities. You know, and so when we went to the UN Development Goals Summit, we wanted young women to be present that were going to be impacted by these goals, and whether they succeeded or not, you know, whether the world would be ambitious in setting these goals or not, you know, and our work at the Malala Fund at that time was to try to secure in these new goals, these global goals that everyone was going to agree to, you know, how many years of education did a girl have a right to? You know, when we started advocating, it was only 9, which, I mean, just think about, would that be acceptable for anyone in your family to finish, you know, school at 9th grade, you know, that's not sufficient. And certainly not for goals that are supposed to last us until 2030. You know, can you imagine how is a young woman supposed to be having agency or being competitive, right? You know,
we're going to a break. So you got to 12 though, right? 12 years?
Yeah, we got to 12. We got to 12 and we brought 2 young women in with Malala, one who is a Nigerian young woman activist where Boko Haram's active, mm-hmm. and another one, the Syrian refugee. So it was a wonderful moment.
Back on the exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Megan Stone is our guest on the JX. She is the co-author with Rachel Vogelstein of the book Awakening, Me Too and the Global Fight for Women's Rights. This takes the whole Me Too movement lens outside the United States and looks at 7 countries around the world to see the progress and the pushback as well in people trying to secure greater rights for women. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. There are some powerful words early in the book, Megan, about cautioning people not to think Me Too happens to other people and that things like religious sanctions of victims don't just happen in other countries.
I think that point is so important, and I'm so grateful that you've raised it in this conversation. You know, I've worked a lot in the Muslim community, and I find parallels all the time, you know, between my own faith life, which I still am a person of faith. I just express it a little differently. But, you know, there's all kinds of stories across all kinds of faith backgrounds, you know, places of faith and no faith where we see that there's a culture of silence and shame for women. You know, in the United States, we had recently the Church Too movement, right? So they took the Me Too hashtag and changed it into Church Too. You know, and some of this kind of came to a head in the Southern Baptist Convention kind of debates here in the United States about just women who are coming forward, who are survivors, and said, my local faith community had silenced me, had shamed me, and that there needs to be more oversight. You know, and they're not the only ones. You know, I don't want to shout out one denomination or sect. You know, we know that this happens across faith traditions. You know, and in Nigeria, in the book, We talked about how women in the northern part of Nigeria, which is very conservative, traditional Muslim community, wound up working together with women in the majority Christian South to come together about abuse that was happening in, you know, two very different faith contexts, but really calling leaders to account and then also working within their communities. For example, in the north, you know, to sit down with leaders of mosques and other religious leaders and talk about, you know, what does the Quran say about this issue? How can we make sure that we have safe space for girls and for women? And so there's real progress that can be made. And I don't think we should reject communities of faith. I think we should continue to shine a bright light and work together, because these are the places where people are going to get married, you know, mourn loved ones when they pass, you know, have children and raise families. So these are important spaces to make sure that we're having these conversations.
And we have a response from one of our listeners already. Here's a call from Anne in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Megan Stone, the author of co-author of Awakening.
Thank you so much. My question is, when are national and international women's rights groups are going to acknowledge that laws limiting or banning abortion are a form of sexual abuse? Thank you.
Thank you for that, Anne.
Thank you so much for that question, Anne. I'm so glad you called in. You know, this is a topic that I know different communities have different perspectives on, and I feel like it's so important to take a step back and not only look at the U.S. context, but also look at other cultural contexts in some of the countries where we work. You know, these are complex issues writ large. You know, and there's been more activism. You know, in the book, we even talk about how women in South America, even in the midst of COVID, you know, came out and were able to secure some changes in reproductive rights that they had been campaigning for decades. And so we've seen that there have been, you know, real points of progress. But we also know, even from our domestic context, of course, that this is a continuing debate. And, you know, you'll watch the U.S. leadership and kind of as it goes back and forth between different administrations, there's something called the global gag rule, which I'm sure she's familiar with, which is that, you know, basically a policy that says that if a facility delivers any sort of abortion or other kinds of services, that they are then extremely limited and unable to get funding. Even if, you know, in the room right next door at the clinic, they're offering services to pregnant mothers to make sure that they have safe births and deliveries and healthy children. And so that's a complex one. I want to believe there's a way forward in all this that we can actually take into account not only differing perspectives on reproductive rights in country and in our own, but really put the focus on serving women, you know, and finding better ways to develop and deliver policies. But this is definitely a live topic of debate globally. Your listener is absolutely right.
Thanks again for the call, Anne. Megan Stone, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, her book with Rachel Vogelstein, Awakening, Me Too and the Global Fight for Women's Rights. So seven countries, Brazil, China, Egypt, Nigeria, Pakistan, Sweden, and Tunisia. Why choose these seven? I mean, you've given some examples already.
Well, it was so hard because when we started digging into the research, you know, there were over 100 countries that we found that this hashtag and this campaign was being used and really winning some tremendous victories and creating space to have these conversations sometimes for the very first time. You know, and you may not know this unless you knew what hashtags to look for, right? Because they were in other languages. And so we worked together actually with Twitter at one point to really map out, you know, all the countries that we saw the movement getting traction online. Ultimately, we decided to pick these countries because we wanted to show that the movement could succeed and that women were making gains in terms of legal, economic, political equality, you know, demanding their rights in a variety of contexts, you know, different religions, different socioeconomic kind of statuses of these different countries, different histories, different parts of the world, different languages, different religions. Really, we wanted to have this kind of group that showed, you know, you can be in some place as restrictive as northern Nigeria or, you know, in Pakistan when it comes to women's rights, or you can even be in a place like Sweden, you know, that many people look to as this kind of perfect heaven, you know, this Valhalla of women's rights and equality. And guess what? You're going to find women everywhere are having challenges in this regard and having to assert themselves and fight for their rights and using similar tactics and techniques like digital organizing, you know, coming together over WhatsApp, Facebook, Twitter, really finding each other and then bringing that together with offline organizing to really demand change.
Let's talk about Brazil then, because the Women's Spring came 4 years before people started using the Me Too hashtag. And so talk about the Women's Spring and what got it started.
Absolutely. So I want to give credit to my co-author, Rachel Vogelstein, who really focused on the Brazil chapter and traveled there and spent deep time with the women in community there. And so, you know, Brazil is a country where, you know, there's a lot of, you know, right now with the current leader, especially Bolsonaro, like very misogynistic, populist kind of leadership. And, you know, women of color, Afro-Brazilian women, you know, women living in disenfranchised, vulnerable communities economically have been, you know, pushed to the margins and really pushed down. And, you know, and so what happened was women started coming together, really demanding their rights, you know, stepping forward and campaigning. And then this actually winds up resulting in this incredible woman, Marielle Franco, who is a Black lesbian woman from the favelas, becoming part of Rio's city council and becoming this incredible leader and, you know, being able to really come into that space and demand justice for her community. You know, in the book we talk about, Marielle was tragically assassinated. And, you know, to this day, they're still pursuing those who, you know, enacted this horrific attack that took her life. But what they did in that, the women's movement there, they said they thought they were going to silence us, and it's almost as if they stepped on an anthill, you know, because now more women than ever are running for office. You know, and so this really points to the women organizing online has, you know, yielded tremendous gains, but it builds on, you know, often decades of women's organizing in these countries. And so just moving that into the digital space, but also shows there's still tremendous danger. You know, Marielle paid with her life, you know, for asking for her rights and the rights of women like herself. So the backlash is real, but we do believe it's evidence that these movements are succeeding, right? You know, power is not going to concede anything without a fight, in the words of Frederick Douglass. You know, so, you know, even though there's tremendous price to be paid for many of these women, we see that as evidence that they are really, really starting to win the fight. And that's why some powers that be are threatened.
Megan Stone, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, co-author with Rachel B. Vogelstein of the book Awakening, Me Too and the Global Fight for Women's Rights, which explores the Me Too movement by that name and others in 7 different countries around the world and quite different ones from each other. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Your questions, your comments about how women are fighting back about sexual abuse and assault and harassment around the world. Welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Let's move on to China, which must be a very tough place to try to operate a Me Too movement. And a picture, though, tells a lot, as it does at the beginning of this chapter. The Chinese government banned Me Too, and then how did the people in the campaign get around that?
Well, this is the incredible creativity that we found of women organizers in this movement. You know, when you look at China, obviously we know, even if you look at the recent pro-democracy movement protests, you know, extremely difficult context to try to be advocating for rights of any kind. And so, of course, women activists ran afoul of the government. You know, we saw this over and over again, that, you know, these totalitarian or authoritarian governments can become extremely threatened by anyone that's good at organizing, you know, and women activists are extremely good at organizing. And so their online activism is seen as a tremendous threat. So, you know, even in that context, feminists were able to organize, and Me Too, as it exploded globally, you know, got real traction. You know, in China, it was women calling for investigations into professors, you know, who had committed sexual harassment. You know, women were coming forward and started using really creative tactics. You know, they were using the blockchain to put complaints out in a way that they could not be erased by the government, that the censors would not be able to remove those allegations no matter what happened to those women. And a number of the women that we write about have had to either leave China entirely or been disappeared as a result of their activism. So again, really doing brave and hard work. They decided they could also get around the censors using images, like you said, because the text phrase Me Too was even banned. You could not use the phrase Me Too on social media in China. And so women used images that were harder to track, right? So they would use an emoji picture of a rice bowl, which is pronounced me, and then a bunny, which is pronounced too. And so this way the censors couldn't control their speech by immediately detecting and deleting the posts, right? So they were constantly being really courageous and creative to try to elude the censors and call for action.
Yeah, that was wonderful to see that. Basically the rice rabbit was the way to get around Me Too restrictions. Let's talk about one of the people though who felt like she had to get out of there, and that would be Luo Zhiji, a Chinese PhD student. A very long journey to tell her story.
Yes, absolutely. So she decided to come forward publicly and pave the way for other Chinese women to do so, and she was really, you know, bolstered by this global movement. And so organizers began circulating petitions at Beihang University calling for an investigation into a professor that Luo Zhiji had accused, right? And they said, not only do we want this professor to be held to account, we want a permanent tool or mechanism to address sexual harassment at universities, right? This is so important because how are women supposed to further themselves in their careers economically, have real agency? You know, again, if going to college or university is a place where sexual harassment and assault allowed to proliferate. And so, you know, they saw that this was risky to come forward. So, you know, she and other organizers got support from alumni. You know, they signed this petition together. The professor was ultimately fired in just 10 days. And so this was a huge success for these women, but she paid a tremendous price for coming forward. You know, and that is what we've seen around the world. You know, we've seen, you know, I can share even in another country like Pakistan, even this weekend I was getting messages on WhatsApp from some of the organizers of the Women's March saying that some of them have had to go into hiding. Yesterday I got messages from another women activist whose name's Mazen Hassan that we write about in the chapter about Egypt. And she reached out to say, the judge has called me back again to be questioned tomorrow. What am I going to do? Can you help me in any way to keep shining a bright light? You know, so we've seen everything from women disappearing to women paying with their lives to women having to go into hiding, losing jobs, having family members threatened, their physical safety threatened. You know, but to a T, what these women have said to us is, we see these risks. We've decided to accept them. We believe that this is too important. And so they're stepping forward, and we really want to see leaders support them. We want to see global leaders do more to support these women.
Let's move on then to Egypt and Tunisia taken together in one chapter. Tunisia, as you point out, passed a law in 2017 combating violence against women, but has it had much effect?
It did, you know, and I think this is a really complex topic right now,
yes.
You know, because of what's happening in Tunisia, right? You know, and it's really heartbreaking to see the unrest there right now because women played such an important role in, you know, forming a new constitution and a new government, you know, after the uprisings of 2011, what we call in the United States Arab Spring, although most people in the region are not fans of that term. But the revolutions that happened in 2011, Tunisia was a success story. You know, here was a place where there was a pretty peaceful transfer compared to what was happening in other countries. They went from this authoritarian leader, Ben Ali, to literally forming a new constitution where, you know, women were able to make sure that their rights for the first time were really protected in this document and the constitution of this new government for this country. They passed laws that made it so there would be parity, so equality between the genders in political parties. So they have to put as many women forward for running for office for parliament as men. And this is a huge change. And it resulted in things like the 2017 law. You know, if women hadn't been able to lead, hadn't been able to be in the parliament to fight for this, it wouldn't have passed. And women started using the law. You know, they started being able to come forward and assert their rights. There's always issues around enforcement. You know, it's like you can pass a law, but, you know, do the police actually show up, you know, when there is a violation? Does the court take it seriously? You know, is the court system even functional in some of these countries? You know, in many countries, it's either so delayed and so broken a system that even if you get into court, you may be there for years and years, you know. But in Tunisia, real progress has been made. And so I think as we all kind of continue to watch what's happening right now in Tunisia, you know, really hoping that these hard-fought gains are not going to be lost, right? That whatever's going to come in the next days and weeks ahead in Tunisia with this kind of governmental crisis, you know, hopefully women's role will be preserved because they fought so hard to achieve these wins.
We're about 2 minutes from a break. Just want to give you a time warning here, but I want to ask about the story of Zuhir Makhlouf and how he ended up the focus of protests in Tunisia.
Yes, so Zuhir Makhlouf was a member of parliament. He was a longtime human rights activist and lawyer. But what happened was there was a school girl, a young woman, who was walking outside her school, and she noticed that there was a man kind of watching her, and she kind of started looking at him because she was worried he was going to follow her, maybe attack her. She realized that he was masturbating in his car looking at her. She started yelling, and she started taking photos, having no idea that it was this man, Makhlouf, who's a member of parliament. And, you know, she posted the photos to social media. Other young women were like, this is who this is. This is a man who was just elected to parliament. And so this movement in Tunisia called Enazeda, which just means me too in Tunisian Arabic, had started to come together and really call for, you know, justice in telling these stories. It went viral, huge amount of attention, and ultimately resulted in Makhlouf being forced to resign from his political party. Later, he defiantly decided to stay in parliament, we found out. Right now, parliament in Tunisia is dissolved. So, you know, there's continuing action happening. I think this is one of the challenges sometimes in writing about things that are really newsworthy. There's still things happening every day. But, you know, women had a historic protest in front of parliament and did the Chilean kind of protest anthem that folks may have seen online, A Rapist in Your Past. And so they did that performance and protest in front of the parliament in a really incredible way. So, you know, this is the first time that somebody was held to account at that level. And so we see that as real progress.
All right. We'll talk more about progress in countries around the world. 7 countries in all are profiled in the book Awakening, Me Too and the Global Fight for Women's Rights by Rachel Vogelstein and Megan Stone. Megan Stone is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with her. We can take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join the conversation. We return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening to us on the JX. We are talking about women around the world and the incredible pressure that they are under to deliver sexual goods to men in positions of power. In other words, the Me Too movement, but taken more broadly beyond the United States. We look at 7 different countries in the book Awakening, Me Too and the Global Fight for Women's Rights by Rachel Vogelstein and Megan Stone at the Council on Foreign Relations. Megan Stone is our guest on the exchange, and you can join us as we discuss the countries where the Me Too movement has taken root. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And I don't want people to misunderstand what I just said. We're focusing on 7 countries, but there's evidence, I believe, Megan, that there's been Me Too activity in all 193 countries, isn't there?
Yeah, we saw evidence of the movement in over 100 countries globally, and we're sure there were even more, you know, because the incredible thing about this movement is that it's 2 things at the same time that make you go, oh, could those be in the same space, the same moment? And it can. It's being transnational, meaning that women are connecting across borders, right, across countries in very different contexts, taking inspiration from each other, you know, learning strategies and tactics from each other, encouraging each other when things are difficult, celebrating each other's victories, right? You know, and that kind of is seen in things like the Chilean Rapist in Your Past, you know, performance demonstration. Here's this Chilean women's art collective that does this entire protest performance about sexual assault, you know, performs it, it goes viral, women are doing everything from recreating it in front of Harvey Weinstein's trial in New York to Tunisia to, you know, all over the world. We've seen amazing examples of this, you know. So it's transnational, but then it's also hyper-localized. So that means you can take Me Too, and we saw this. We saw that women translated Me Too into their own languages or use their own versions of the hashtag and could call for very specific things in their community. Maybe there's a specific government official or a specific law that they want to change. And so the movement's really open source, you know, and this really comes from digital organizing. You know, it's something that's cohesive, but it also creates a lot of space for women to advocate for their rights in the way that makes sense for them, you know, in their local context, not in a Western or global North, you know, feminist way, in whatever way works, you know, for their local community from what they know to be true and what they need.
Working in that cyber realm, though, I imagine has its own pitfalls, too, because it's not hard to see evidence of people saying just horrible things about women online because they are anonymous. And so it seems like there'd be some traffic going the other direction as well.
Yeah, I can tell you've been on some social media, Jeff.
Oh, yes.
don't hang out in the comments if you can help it.
Right.
You know, it's real, you know, and like all the women we talked to, you know, said this. You know, they said that technology, social media, digital organizing, it's been transformative for them, but it's also not this panacea, right? You know, you also have a lot of the same things that happen in real life, you know, in real time. So threats, harassment, people can dox you. If you don't know what doxing is, that's basically when someone publishes personal information online.
Like your address and phone number, yeah.
Yeah, your phone number, you know, so that other people can start harassing you and even physically threaten you or come to your home and, you know, present real danger. So, you know, I think of women like in Pakistan, there's this phenomenal attorney that we write about, Nigat Dad, and she started an organization called the Digital Rights Foundation that really focuses a lot on this. You know, how can women report this? What do you do if it crosses the line from somebody having a little bit of keyboard courage to threaten you to, you know, I think this is actionable. I think this could really put me in danger. And so she's done a lot of work around that because she's also experienced a lot of threats herself, you know, for speaking up online. So I think it's, you know, important we look at technology just in a holistic way. It's groundbreaking in a lot of ways. It democratized the movement. It's expanded the movement. It's been able to make sure that the movement has overdue diversity and inclusion, but that doesn't mean that it's a perfect tool. You know, there still are some threats, but women did say, you know, we wouldn't have found each other if we couldn't post on social media. Like, what were they going to do? Go to the town square and start shouting out, you know, the name of the government official or the professor or the religious teacher who had harassed them? You know, what they did is they posted and all of a sudden other women would come forward and say, wait, me too. Like, this happened to me too. The same person, the same leader did this to me. They would never have found each other. It would never have been exposed.
So in a sense, the cyber realm gives them a way to connect, but they're still functioning within a society where people get face-to-face. And in some of these societies, like Pakistan, like Nigeria, there are still fairly large taboos against even bringing up the subject of sexual abuse, isn't there?
There are, you know, and I feel like it's important to start from that place of humility in our own society. You know, I think your question before about faith communities even here in the United States, you know, this is still a hard thing for survivors to talk about, period, anywhere. And there are plenty of places in the United States where women, girls can still not come forward. And I also want to say boys, you know, and men, you know, that in Tarana Burke herself, you know, the founder of the Me Too movement makes that point always stridently, you know, that it is really for all survivors. They are overwhelmingly girls and women, but that doesn't mean they are only girls and women, and that we can actually come together across genders to advocate. But yeah, you know, sometimes just saying this happened is the taboo is on the woman for bringing it up. You cannot discuss this. It's considered bringing shame, you know, on the community. You know, we don't have those problems here. Don't bring this up. You know, this makes us look bad. You know, and so women are silenced in all kinds of ways, and they pay real prices, you know, for coming forward. They could be blackmailed. They could be blacklisted from their workplaces. You know, one woman in Egypt, Mael Shami, worked at a newspaper, was one of the first women to come forward and use new laws there against sexual harassment in the workplace. You know, and she very quickly was targeted by the LCC government. the regime was not happy, you know, that she came forward and started talking about this. It's not polite conversation and certainly not at a state-supported newspaper by a totalitarian regime. And, you know, so she was told, you know, you're going to be blacklisted from the media. You are not going to be able to work again in this field as a journalist, you know. So all kinds of tools are used to silence women.
I noticed in Egypt that that sometimes the way to get people in trouble is women who have spoken up is to connect them to things like the Muslim Brotherhood, which, of course, was in power for a while and then it was banned again.
You're exactly right on that. You know, like, this is really where we see in countries where just advocating for your rights as a woman can start to trip these wires that are very powerful, you know, in terms of government control. You know, in terms of the al-Sisi regime, right now currently in Egypt, that's the leadership. It is a very dangerous place to be a political activist of any position, you know. And so whether you're a member of the Muslim Brotherhood or you're a women's rights activist, you're considered a threat to the state. And this isn't just some, you know, theoretical danger that you're in. This is life-threatening danger you can be in. You know, Egypt even recently announced that they are going to sentence to death, you know, 12 political dissidents who are a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. You know, and I think the point is, it's, you may not agree with all the positions that a particular political party may have, but there should be safe space for people to come forward to be able to have political dialogue. That was the victory in Tunisia. You know, in Tunisia, more conservative Muslim political parties came together with the feminist movement there and hammered out a new constitution. So it is possible to do that work. But, you know, in Egypt, this is going to put you in tremendous danger. And, you know, we need to change our policy towards Egypt to respond to this. We give them extraordinary amounts of military aid. U.S. taxpayer dollars goes to prop up an authoritarian regime. Maybe we should change that. So right now there's actually a push to link even more aid to Egypt to human rights concerns, including women's rights. And we hope that succeeds.
All right. So we've talked about a bunch of countries where there are still taboos and things like that, and a strong strain of religion along with the politics there. But then you get to Sweden at the end of the book. And who is Cissi Wallin, and how long did she wait to tell her story?
So she's an incredible figure. You know, she really came forward in the midst, again, of this, you know, so-called feminist utopia in Sweden, where, you know, women really came together to start to call out what was happening in their respective industries. She was a big leader in the movement there. You know, and women, in response to her coming forward, they organized across 65 different industries, and they used everything, you know, from humorous hashtags to other tools to try to make the point that this was still systemic and still a problem in Sweden. And so, for example, like, the restaurant workers there used a hashtag that means we are boiling with rage, and healthcare workers used a hashtag that translates to now it will really hurt. And, you know, women came forward in this tremendous way. She made her allegations, and so many other women came forward. A tremendous amount of women came forward to accuse the same man. He ultimately used a tool against her that has been recreated all over the world, which is to then file for defamation, right? So saying that you've defamed my character by making these allegations. And unfortunately, you know, what happened was that was successful. And even the judge in the case, you know, pretty much said that she had performed a public service by coming forward, because so many other women came forward and realized that their experience was not unique, but that under the way that the defamation law was written, you know, in Sweden, that they had to find her guilty. You know, and so, again, women are paying tremendous prices. I'll tell you, even in writing this book, we had many phone calls with lawyers, you know,
to make sure that we were
having, well, number one, fair language. You know, I think that's important to underline, is just due process. You know, when Tarana Burke says, you know, believe all women, she's not saying that every woman that comes forward is accurate in their allegations or truthful. What she's saying is that everybody that comes forward should be taken seriously, that if an allegation or charge is made, it deserves a serious investigation. And that's what believe all women means. It means let's take this as a serious matter and appropriately investigate. But, you know, we're not saying that there shouldn't be due process. There should be, you know, but this is why women are going online, right? They're going online because they're not getting justice in courtrooms, because HR doesn't take things seriously because they're in a country where there is no human resources department or there is no law that they can avail themselves of, you know. And so, you know, it's really about just making sure that, you know, we're being fair to women and giving them a fair chance to come forward. But in talking to the legal team and reviewing the book, we had to be very careful, of course, you know, because we're not a court of law, and nor were we making statements about guilt or innocence unless a court had decided that. But we were making the point that these women's allegations need to be heard.
So for the people listening who are inspired to want to do something either within the United States or elsewhere in the world, and if they're talking about elsewhere in the world, you do point out the point of your book is not about exporting white Western feminism. So what are the kinds of help that can be given to people elsewhere in the world to try to give a little boost to the Me Too movement in those countries?
That's such a great question. You know, we really hope that people won't read the book and just be inspired by these women. You know, that doesn't actually create action. We want you to be inspired and then take the action. And so if you are willing to read this wonderful book, I hope you'll come along with us on this journey with these women and, you know, read about everything that they've achieved. You can look in the book in the back, and there is a list of all the different organizations that these women have founded and continue to lead, both the women in the book and other leading women's organizations globally. And so if you want to give personally, that is a great way to support these women. Another thing that you could do is call for change from our elected leaders about how, as a country, we deliver global aid, right? So international development assistance. If you look globally at all the aid that's given, less than one penny of every dollar goes to a women's organization, a women's rights organization. So less than one penny of every dollar, which is just, you know, regrettably low. That's the kindest way I can put it. Ridiculously low, considering we're talking about half the population, right? So we think that needs to change. And we argue for that in the book, that governments like the United States and others could do a better job, you know, in supporting these women, giving them the resources they need to actually further this work. You know, the women in the book are, most of them, operating on a shoestring. It's a lot of gumption and a lot of creativity. You know, that's why digital organizing is uniquely suited, right, to this kind of activism. But they could do so much more if they had the support that they deserve. You know, in the U.S., we can find ways, you know, to lead differently on this issue and to make sure more funding is going directly to the women who are leading change in their communities. They know what they need. They're going to be there. They've always been there. They're not leaving. They have the deep relationships, and they know best, you know, what's needed to change their lives and the lives of their daughters and children. And so we need to support them.
Seven countries are chosen for examples in the book: Brazil, China, Egypt, Nigeria, Pakistan, Sweden, and Tunisia. But obviously many more across the world where women are still struggling to gain full rights, as covered in the book Awakening, Me Too and the Global Fight for Women's Rights by Rachel Vogelstein and Megan Stone. Megan Stone has been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She and Rachel work at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you for joining us today, Megan. Good to have you.
Thank you, and thank you for being a man shining a light on women's issues. I just want to shout you out for that and say thank you so much.